This evening, we're going to cover the fifth trumpet. I'm actually pacing myself a little bit slower so that our co-teacher here, Eric, can pick up with chapter 10, given some of his work responsibilities and so forth. Right, he needed a couple of weeks to be able to make the preparations for chapter 10. So instead of trying to take in the fifth and sixth trumpet in one fell swoop, I'm going to take the fifth trumpet tonight, and we'll do the sixth trumpet next week, and then the pump should be primed, you know, for Eric to come in and quench everybody's thirst with chapter 10. Okay? That actually might be fairly apt analogy to use, since in chapter 10, John does get to eat, right? It's a book, but some of us are just bibliophiles enough that we would actually might enjoy that, being given a book to eat. So, just a quick overview here, as we're considering the big picture, the first five seals, I think it's accurate to say, at least focus our attention using the imagery that would have been directly applicable to that generation that John is writing to. So I think that these events are primarily focused on the destruction of the temple in 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem in the early 2nd century. And so this John's generation, roughly speaking, but then, of course, the sixth seal takes us in answer to the martyrs of that generation, in answer to their prayers, takes us to the final judgment, to the cosmic upheaval. Okay, then with the seventh seal, we are introduced to the next series of judgments, and that's where we are right now, the judgment of the trumpets. We've looked at the first four of the trumpets, and we've seen how the trumpets are grouped in four plus three trumpets, the three last trumpets grouped together as three woes. We'll begin to look at that tonight. And then with the seventh trumpet, we have the introduction then of the last series of numbered judgments, and that's the bowl judgments, the seven bowls, as they contain the last outpouring of the wrath of God. And so here we are, I believe, considering the judgments of God that bring about salvation. The salvation of his people come through the midst of these judgments, and he's also exacting his vengeance upon unbelievers, but he's doing so partially. And so these are judgments that are taking place throughout history, between the advents of Christ, between his first coming and his second coming. So these are things that have been happening since the first century. These are things that are continuing to happen in our day. These are things that will happen. This defines our time until the coming of Jesus Christ. And so, just real quickly, a recap on giving ourselves kind of a biblical understanding of the trumpets here. In Revelation, we see them functioning in a context of liturgy, as the trumpets are a response to the prayers of the saints. We're reminded here of the altar that is in heaven, and the incense that is offered up with the prayers of the saints from the altar in heaven, of the 24 elders who are at worship at the blast of the seventh trumpet. And so we have here a liturgical context for these trumpets, okay, much like what we find in the Old Testament, where trumpets were used in the liturgy of Israel to call the people to worship and also to sound forth praises to God. We have also a context of covenant warfare, as the kingdom of Christ is to conquer the kingdoms of this world, as we see with the last trumpet in chapter 11, verse 15, and as judgment on idolatry, which we see here in chapter 9. We'll look at next week when we look at the sixth trumpet, God's judgment upon idolatry, covenant warfare, his war, going to war against the gods of this world, the gods of our imagination. And then we have the trumpets functioning here in for warning, which also means that the trumpets speak of mercy, because they bring a partial judgment. A third is destroyed, serving as a warning of a more complete judgment, a more complete destruction to come. And so the partiality of these judgments is itself mercy, because it is to awaken people to the danger that lies ahead in the final judgment, and so is implicitly a call to repentance. Now, what we find, sadly enough, in chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, is that the reprobate do not heed the warning. They don't listen to the warning blasts. But that doesn't diminish the mercy at all, because the blast was made. The trumpet was sounded. The alarm was sounded. They chose to ignore it. They will choose to ignore it. It also, the trumpets also speak of the day of the Lord, which we find referenced there in chapter 11, which includes several things. The wrath of God. The day of the Lord is a day of wrath. The nations raged, but your wrath came, and the time for the dead to be judged. It is a day of reward. It says, and for the rewarding of your servants, the prophets and saints, and those who fear your name, both small and great. And it is the day of final judgment, or when we refer here to lex talionis, that is God's standard of judgment, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, as we see here at the end of that verse, and for destroying the destroyers of the earth. What do you do to people who destroy? You destroy them. That's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's the punishment is fitting for the crime. It speaks then, of course, of final judgment. 11:19, we see again that eschatological earthquake that announces the final judgment of God, and with that, the enthronement of the Lord and of His Christ. Not, of course, in the sense that He just begins to reign, but in the sense of the universal recognition of His reign. Now, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Okay, so there's a bit of a review of some things we've already looked at with the trumpets and kind of the Old Testament background and present context in Revelation of how they're functioning. Just a quick reminder of the literary structure of the trumpets that it mirrors the literary structure of the seals. With the seals, remember there's the group of four seals and then the group of three. The four are marked out by the horsemen, right? With the opening of the first four seals, you get a rider that comes out with each seal. So these four are kind of grouped together by that symbolism. And then you have the three seals. Well, with the trumpets, you have the three seals at the end, 5, 6, and 7, marked out as three woes. And so the first four seals kind of grouped together, and you see that they're thematically grouped, as we looked at before. The first four trumpets mark a return to chaos in creation, and they also allude to the plagues of the Exodus from Egypt. Now, that allusion to the plagues of the Exodus is going to continue in this fifth trumpet. Might have said seal, say trumpet. And then, of course, between the sixth seal and the seventh seal, we had an interlude. Remember chapter 7, where we see the 144,000, and we see the innumerable company of the saints, the mutually interpretive vision of the church. Well, we see the same thing with the trumpets. After the sixth trumpet is blasted, then we have an interlude before the seventh trumpet. So the seventh trumpet will be in chapter 11. The sixth trumpet was in chapter 9. So between then, there we have chapter 10 and half of chapter 11, which again gives us an interlude that gives us some insight into the life of the church and the function of the church in this era, in this time of great calamity. So that brings us down to where we are today, chapter 8, verse 13. So we've just finished looking at the first four trumpets, decreation and Exodus plagues in the background here Verse 13 says, "Then I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, 'Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow.'" So here we have an announcement by an eagle, or it should be translated vulture. I think either one of those, the word that's used here in the Greek is translated both as eagle and as vulture in different contexts. And both of those birds feature in contexts, particularly the eagle in context, particularly of announcements from God. The vulture, though, particularly in eschatological scenes of judgment, like Jesus, you know, says, you know, that you see where the carcass is, the vultures gather, and he's referring here to being able to tell the signs of the times, right? And later in the book of Revelation, when the great harlot Babylon is laid out, you know, her carcass is laid out for the birds of heaven to come and feast on the flesh of the enemies of the Lamb. And it doesn't say what those birds are, it just says birds, but kind of gives me the picture again of that of the vulture circling where the corpse is, where the carcass is. But either way, if you can look at these Old Testament texts, and here you'll find various references and associations of the eagle or vulture with announcements of judgment or scenes of judgment. In several of these passages, the eagle is used as a symbol of the swiftness and power of an enemy who is going to bring devastation through warfare to either God's people as a judgment upon them for their covenant breaking, or against, like, Moab, for example, because of their hostility toward Israel, toward God's people. Here, the announcement of woe is to a particular people. It is to those who dwell on the earth. Now, that's not the first time we've seen that reference. We saw it in chapter 3 and verse 10. I think I made commentary then that those who dwell on the earth is not referring to everybody who happens to be present on earth at that time. Okay. Now, in dispensational circles, that is generally how this phrase is understood. They take those who dwell on the earth to mean everybody who's living on earth, and that's why they say that the church must be raptured. The church must be raptured before all this happens, because the wrath of God is being poured out upon unbelievers here, and how could the wrath of God possibly be being poured out on the church? And so they must not be dwelling on the earth at that time. But that's to take those who dwell on the earth as, you know, again, a literal reference to everybody who happens to be living on earth. Rather, in the book of Revelation, those who dwell on the earth are intentionally contrasted with believers. Not believers in heaven, mind you, but they're contrasted with believers on earth who are suffering. Those who dwell on the earth get along well under the beast's administration and government. But the saints don't get along so well, right? The saints are beheaded. The saints are persecuted under the beast's government. There you have the distinction that is made between those who dwell on the earth and those who are faithful witnesses for Jesus, those whose home is with Christ, with God, and those whose home is in the city of man. If you use Augustine's phrase, terminology of the city of God and the city of man. So those who dwell on the earth are those whom Augustine would say dwell in the city of man. They're not interested in the city of God. Those who are completely invested only in the kingdoms of this world, to use the language of Revelation, rather than those who are interested in the kingdom of God and of his Christ. So the woes are expressed here against those who dwell on the earth. And these woes are specifically directed against unbelievers. You see that in verse 4, of chapter 9, as they were told not to harm any of the grass of the earth or any green plant or tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Again, I think by saying that, the implication is that there are people present who do have the seal of God on their foreheads. Okay, so they're not to harm those that have the seal. They're only to harm those who don't have the seal of God. So the church is still here. Okay. So this isn't some future time when the church is raptured or gone away from the earth. This is this time when the church is here. But God is bringing judgment directly against the unbelievers in this fifth and sixth trumpet judgment. So let's read the fifth trumpet here in chapter 9, beginning at verse 1. And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it, and they will long to die, but death will flee from them. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lions' teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. So here in the fifth trumpet, we have demonic torment. Just a quick, since we were talking about the three woes, in the sixth trumpet, which we'll look at next week, we have not just demonic torment, but demonic death. That is, death that's brought about to the soul by this judgment, God using these evil, horrific beings to bring about judgment upon unbelievers. And then in the seventh trumpet, we have the final judgment and the enthronement of Jesus Christ. These are the three woes. With this fifth trumpet, we see here Abaddon and his hosts. We see demonic torment. So, if I could summarize what I think all this the symbolism here is pointing toward, what is it all talking about? Is that the kingdoms of man, in cooperation with demons, are tormented by their own evil. So, in verse 1, when the fifth trumpet is blown, he sees a star. He doesn't see the star falling. Notice the tense. He sees a star that has fallen. In other words, what John sees is the result of the fallen star. He sees a star fallen from heaven to earth, and this star was given the shaft to the bottomless pit. Now, of course, he says, well, what is the star? Who is the star? We might say that the star is simply an angel. We see stars, the angels represented as stars, or presented to us as stars in the Bible. But we also see stars as references to human kingdoms. In fact, one precedent that we have, which I think is true to this symbolism here, is that it is both angelic and human, referring to a human king or human kingdom. as we have an angelic or demonic representation of an earthly kingdom. So, for example, in Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15, in what Isaiah calls the taunt against the king of Babylon. Okay, so this is that's not like the ESV heading on this chapter. That's Isaiah's heading for the oracle in Isaiah 14. It's a taunt against the king of Babylon. And what he says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn." This is where people get the word Lucifer from, by the way. And this is where people say, well, who is Satan? Is Lucifer? Lucifer is Satan, and people build their whole doctrine of Satan. And they say, well, see, because it says Lucifer, we know it's the devil. Well, actually, there's no other reference to the devil as Lucifer. This would be the only place. And so if you're going to say this is the devil, then, I mean, you just, it's a leap. It's not, we have no other source that tells us that the devil is Lucifer. Daystar, son of dawn. What we do know for sure is it's Babylon. whether there's demonic or satanic, you know, being behind Babylon, which, I mean, we know there is, ultimately, there is this evil, spiritual evil and wickedness that is at work in this kingdom. But the most direct reference of this oracle is against the king of Babylon himself and against his kingdom. And so here, if you want to say, who is Lucifer? Well, again, all we're doing is actually making a name out of a description here of Daystar. But it would be probably Nebuchadnezzar. But I don't think Nebuchadnezzar's nickname was Lucifer. But anyway, Daystar. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. Wasn't that what Babylon did? You know, they came in and they laid the nations low. Among them was Judah. Jerusalem was laid low under the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars of God, I will set my throne on high. Notice it's above what? Above the stars of God. Now, so what is it that Nebuchadnezzar was trying to do? Well, he wanted to be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords on earth. And all the other stars, that is, all the other little kingdoms, all the other little kings would have to serve him. That's what he wanted. And that's what's portrayed here. He wants to be the ruler of the earth, the God of this world. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Okay. So I think this text is probably what's in the background here for John, as he's referring to an angel that's fallen from heaven and that is given the key to the pit, to the bottomless pit. Just a little bit further argument, maybe, for the idea that this may be both an angelic and a human reference here in this star that has fallen is what we find in Daniel chapter 10, where Gabriel says he was opposed, Gabriel the angel, was opposed by the prince of Persia. And here he seems to be referring to some spiritual being, until he says Michael, the one we know as the archangel from Jude, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia. Now notice that he refers to the prince of Persia as kind of the spiritual being that opposes him, but then he refers to the kings, plural, of Persia, like the rulers of Persia. So again, there seems to be this kind of, there's this earthly reality of these human princes, and yet behind them is the spiritual wickedness at work. He says that he will return then to fight against the prince of Persia, and then the prince of Greece will come. Again, and this is exactly what we see in history, the succession of these empires. With the rise of Greece comes the diminishment of Persia. It's one of Alexander the Great's great achievements, right, is the conquest of Persia. And so the prince of Greece comes. And says, there is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. And so he refers to Michael as being kind of a guardian angel over Jerusalem, over the Jewish people. The rise and fall of these kingdoms on earth then has this heavenly counterpart in this vision of Daniel. And so perhaps that's also what's at play here in the book of Revelation. And we've seen this already. To the angel of the church in Ephesus, to the angel of the church in Smyrna, right? The earthly churches have a heavenly counterpart, heavenly representative. So here this fallen star is given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. And as we've seen already in the book of Revelation, the key indicates authority. When you have a key, then you have charge over something. Okay, and so this angel slash kingdom is given authority. And it's given authority over the bottomless pit. Now, the bottomless pit or the abyss we find in the book of Revelation is the dwelling of demons. It's here in chapter 9. It is the dwelling of Abaddon or Apollyon. He is the king of it in chapter 9:11. It's the domain where the beast arises from. It's the domain where Satan is bound. It represents, as we put all of these various texts together and try to discern what is meant here by this bottomless pit or the abyss, it represents a state of being restricted or confined so that evil is constrained or limited. Being loosed from the pit suggests freedom of activity. Okay, just like Satan came to God and essentially challenged God that no one could love you like Job does unless you were showing him special favors. And so he has no power over Job, right, except what God gives him. And so God gives him a limited power with Job. He says, you can touch the man's life, you can touch his, you know, his family, you can touch his property, you can't touch him, right? So he kind of creates a bubble around Job and gives Satan rather some authority, some freedom with Job's property. And when that fails, Satan comes back and says, yeah, but if you let me at him, let me touch him, then he'll curse you to your face. And so God again gives Satan that freedom to work within in that. So here, and we're going to almost see the exact same pattern here in chapter 9 with the fifth trumpet. It's like, these creatures, these demons, are given power to torment, but not kill. But in the sixth trumpet, they're given power to kill. And so, what we find here, it says here, who has unleashed this on the earth? Who has unleashed this demonic torment on the earth? Well, God ultimately sends the angel down and gives him the key, but who unlocks the door, right? Who invites it? Who brings it in? We do. This is the point. We do. The kingdoms of the earth do this. So, you know, so if we understand here this fallen star to represent human kingdoms as well as demonic, with a demonic backdrop to it, then it is we in our evil, in our shaking our fist in the face of God, that bring this torment on ourselves. Now, you know, as Eric said, that's all by the design of God, right? That's, the self-destructiveness is evil, of evil is all by the design of God. So when humanity rejects God as individuals or as a society, they are unwittingly consorting with the devil and bringing this judgment upon themselves. Jesus said this in John chapter 8. Remember when he is disputing with some of the Pharisees and about their patrimony there, who their father was. You know, and Jesus says, well, they said, well, Abraham is our father. And he says, no, Abraham rejoiced to see my day. And when he saw it, he was glad. You know, if you were the sons of Abraham, you would be glad. And they said, well, we have one God, we have one father, that's God. And Jesus said, no, God sent me. And so if you were the sons of God, then you would believe in me. You would hear my words. And He said, no, I'm going to tell you who your father is. You are of your father, the devil. He was a murderer from the beginning. And that's why you want to kill me. That's why you want to get rid of me. That's why you have nothing to do with me, because the devil has nothing to do with me. And Paul writes in Ephesians 2 and says that there's the spirit who is at work in the sons of disobedience, that is the prince of the power of the air. He's referring here to the devil and to spiritual wickedness. And he's saying that that's the spirit that's at work in the sons of disobedience. That's the spirit that's at work in human rebellion against God. And so when we reject God, and that this is true as individuals, when we reject God's revealed will, and we choose to rely on our own wisdom and to go our own way, we find ourselves walking in step with the devil. We find ourselves in cahoots with the devil. When this happens as a society, when a society snubs its nose at God and says, we're not going to recognize the law of God. We're not going to let God measure our morality. We're not going to let him define what is good and what is evil. We're going to decide that on our own. Then we find ourselves, unwittingly maybe, consorting with the devil, working with him, cooperating with him. So what is the outcome of that? Well, it says, when he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, from the shaft rose smoke, like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Here we have a picture of the darkness of ignorance, the ignorance of God. And if we're ignorant of God, we're ignorant of reality. I was reading Greg Bahnsen, you know, on presuppositional apologetics. And Bahnsen, he makes the point that no fact is neutral. No fact is neutral. Every fact is either believed and confessed in the light of its relation to God, or that relation to God is denied. It doesn't matter. There's nothing neutral. We either recognize all of reality in its relation to its Creator, to our Redeemer, or we don't recognize that relationship. And if we know it in that relationship, then we know it rightly. If we don't know it in that relationship, we don't know it rightly at all. We're missing the main point of everything if we don't know it in relation to God. And so this foul darkness of ignorance of God is also an ignorance of reality. Darkness is a typical symbol of ignorance of God in John's writings. You find this in the Gospel of John. You find it in the epistles of John. And you find it here in the book of Revelation. You know, darkness representing, you know, what happens to mankind when he rejects God, when he rejects the knowledge of God. We wind up in darkness. And so here, this smoke that mankind has invited, we've unlocked the shaft, and what comes out of the shaft is such a cloud of smoke that the heavenly lights are blocked from our sight. They can't bring their light. And you get this picture here that not only is the upper atmosphere darkened, but it's just like we're walking around in a fog. It's just this heavy smoke that's surrounding us in the air, he says. And we're just walking around blind because of the smoke in our eyes. But it gets worse, because verse 3 says, from the smoke came locusts on the earth. Now, these aren't just ordinary locusts, are they? These are no ordinary locusts. I will say, I'm kind of different than preaching. And preaching, you kind of do things in a certain order, and teaching, and just kind of let it all out, let the cat out of the bag from the very beginning, let it all out, right? I think that here these locusts represent the spiritual and psychological torment of the demons working upon human mind and heart. There's no physical devastation. This isn't like a normal locust plague, right? What do locusts normally do? They go and eat plants, right? Is that right, John? Know what they do? They go and they destroy your crops. But these locusts don't have any power to do that. They're told not to harm the grass or the earth or any green plant or any tree. So right away, this is not a normal locust horde, okay? But rather, it is a spiritual and psychological torment. It is an attack on those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And here, the forehead is not incidental. It indicates the protection of our minds and of our thoughts. Ephesians 6:17 refers to the helmet of salvation. As we're going to stand firm against the evil one, we're going to stand firm against the schemes of the devil, we're protected with a helmet of salvation. And so, and also the word torment here is very typically used of this kind of inner turmoil, this inner anguish. And so I think that understanding the symbolism here to refer primarily to this inner turmoil of the soul or torment of the mind is what's happening. As, of course, what happens when we become ignorant of God? We are left in the darkness of our own souls and in the darkness of satanic lies. You know, and that will eventually work itself out in this kind of anguish, this anguish of soul, this torment of the mind. It says it's for 5 months. Now, again, we recognize in the book of Revelation that numbers are symbolic and time frames are symbolic. So, you know, we might say, well, what 5 months? Did this happen in 5 months back in the first century? Did this happen 5 months, you know, down toward the end of time? Does this happen? You know, what 5 months? Well, some have suggested that it reflects the life cycle of locusts. I really haven't done any research on locusts in preparation for this lesson. Maybe I should have. So I don't know whether that's accurate or not. But I think that what we do find is these kinds of references indicate the limited nature of this judgment. For example, in verse 5 it says, they're given power to torment them, but not to kill them. And so I think the 5 months just indicates that this is a limited judgment. Just what we've been seeing with the trumpet judgments is that it is a third, it's a third, it's a third. These are partial judgments. And so there's limits here. We're not in hell yet. I mean, some of this description may sound like hell on earth in a way, but we're not in hell yet. The reality is these things are limited now. This is partial for what havoc, evil actually wreaks upon our souls. It says it's like the torment of a scorpion, and scorpion sting was used proverbially, as you can imagine, in a region where these little critters are crawling around, and you don't like to, you know, lift up a pot in your home and find one there because, you know, dangerous. So it's used proverbially of painful life experiences. So we find the word like the torment of a scorpion is a simile. And we find that similes all throughout here. It's like this, it's like that, it's like this. You know, none of this is meant to give us some kind of like artists, you know, you're not going to get a sketch artist from the police department like hair like a woman, like teeth like a lion, and you know, you come out with it. I've actually seen you know, artistic representations of this locusts, okay? I'm not sure whether they look horrific or ridiculous. That's not the point, right? Our point is not to get an artist's sketch out of this thing. But it does show us, as we'll see in a moment, the perversity of evil here. But the way that a scorpion sting burns in the skin, it burns in the body, that's what this darkness that's brought on by demonic lies, ignorance of God, that's what happens in the soul. That's the torment in the mind. The torment of evil, especially when self-inflicted, is soul-destroying, so that death is preferred to life. That's what we read in verse 6. In those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. And I think that there are so many places in our society where we see this. I was reading an article not too long ago about the number of millennials that are dying because of drug abuse. Number of millennials dying, and it's prescription drugs, it's methamphetamines, the drug culture has multiplied. Nancy Reagan's war on drugs didn't really eradicate that problem, and what we're finding is that even in affluent areas of our society, this is still plaguing young people. And I'm sure not just young people, but that's what the article covered, was the rise in the incidence of this in young people. The good news is those who are sealed with the seal of the living God on their foreheads are protected from this demonic deception and torment. Remember chapter 7, if you go back over there, verses 2 and 3, I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the earth and sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And we read here that these demonic beings are allowed to torment only those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So those who have the seal of the living God are protected from this demonic deception and torment. That's good news for us. It's good. This doesn't mean that we can be careless about the schemes of the devil. Paul, of course, would call us to be vigilant. Peter says that our enemy, our adversary, the devil, is like a roaring lion roaming around seeking whom he may devour. And so we're not to be, casual or careless when it comes to Satan's lies and deceptions. We need to be on our guard. But the good news is that because we've been sealed by God, because he has given us his word and his spirit, as we studied this morning from the larger catechism, because he has given us his word and his spirit, we are sealed by him so that we can know the truth, be protected against these lies. We find this here in the book of Revelation, just in chapters 2 and 3, with the address to the churches, to those seven churches. We have Jesus giving us his word. Every one of them begins, "the words of," and I put Jesus here in kind of parentheses because it doesn't actually say the words of Jesus, it just uses different descriptive titles for Jesus, right? The words of the one who walks among the lampstands and has the seven stars of God in his right hand, and the words of the one who has a sharp two-edged sword protruding from his mouth, and these descriptions of Jesus, but it's the words of Jesus that are given. And then what does it say at the end of each one of them? The one who has ears to hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And so we have the Word of Christ, and we have the Spirit of Christ bringing us truth, leading us in truth, so that we're protected from these lies and this darkness. The evil of this human and demonic alliance is grotesquely perverse. You see that particularly here in these the hybrid nature of these locusts. Now, again, we're not to make a sketch of these locusts, but when the way that he keeps using it's like this and like that and like this and like that, we almost can't imagine how can you possibly have all these disparate descriptions in one being? Just it sounds either ridiculous or horrifying, right? But it's certainly not natural, and I think that's the point that John is trying to make. There's nothing of godly order about this. This is what happens when chaos reigns, right? Is this kind of perversity? It says in verse 7, in appearance the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces, they were like human faces. Their hair like women's hair. Now, you women are probably like, what's wrong with women's hair? What's with that? But I don't think that the point here is just women's hair in general, but because women's hair tends to be longer, so when it's disheveled, you know, it's a little more maybe crazy looking than what, you know, mine would look, you know. I mean, mine may look crazy, but it's not because there's much of it to do anything with, right? It says that teeth, like lion's teeth, breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails like scorpions. You put all these little pieces, you know, together, and you wind up with something that is a hodgepodge of aspects of creation, kind of a chaotic mix of God's good creation, but twisted and perverted by evil. Some have suggested here, and I think there's probably some legitimacy to this, that with the imagery of the war chariots and the horses and the long hair might have evoked the fear of the Parthians. It's kind of a common description of the Parthians. I might be mistaken, but I think it would be fair to say this is basically Iranians. Iranians on the border of the Roman Empire. There were stories that circulated that Nero was actually going to raise an army of Parthians to come and destroy the city of Rome and take control of the empire, you know, even though he's dead. They're believed to be dead. See, something that he faked his death, and he was going to come back and, you know, wreak havoc on Rome. So it could be that fears of the fall of Rome are used by John as symbols of the self-destruction of all the cities of man. So wouldn't that be the irony, you know, that Nero, one of the Roman emperors, comes back and destroys Rome? And it could be that John is using this kind of known symbolism to speak this truth, that it doesn't matter if it's Rome or Babylon or Greece or America or Germany or Russia, but when we unleash this kind of wickedness, when we unleash this kind of darkness, the result of that evil will be self-destruction. One of the things that we see here, G.B. Caird, in his commentary, brought this out most memorably, and I didn't actually write down the quote, but maybe I should have. But John reminds us that Satan and demons may stir up a lot of trouble, but in this world, evil ultimately has a human face. And I see that here. I don't think that it's an accident that these scorpions, though they may have many bestial qualities about them, their face is human. Face is human. Just going back to verse 1, how do we interpret the fallen star? It's not just an angel. It's not just a demon. There's some human element to this. The kingdoms of man in rebellion against God. And it's humanity himself that's bringing this kind of trouble to his own soul. We don't see it that way. So, right, humanity's troubles always are somebody else's fault. Right? Remember, I think it was Ahab. Remember how wicked Ahab, the king of Israel, was? He married Jezebel, and together they were basically converting everybody from the worship of the true God, from worship of Yahweh, to the worship of Baal. They were introducing the Baal cult, and they were introducing the female goddess Asherah. And they had hundreds of prophets of Baal and hundreds of prophetesses of Asherah and prophets of Asherah. You know, and they, there was still a little school of prophets of the Lord that were remaining in Israel, but that was dwindling to the point where Elijah, remember, he said, I'm the only one left. Well, no, you're not the only one left, but it was getting rough. It was some hard days. Ahab was a wicked man. Remember, Ahab, he wanted a vineyard, and the man that owned the vineyard didn't want to give it up because it was his piece of inheritance in the promised land. He says, no, I can't give that up. That's my family's land. And so Jezebel said, you know, oh, Ahab, you're the king. You know, you can have whatever you want. And so they murdered Naboth, took his vineyard. So the king didn't have enough gardens. He didn't have enough vineyards of his own. No, he had to have Naboth because he coveted it. He was a wicked king. He abused his own people. He led them astray from God. Do you remember what he said when he saw Elijah for the first time after about 3.5 years? Remember what he called Elijah? You troubler of Israel. That's what he called Elijah. Elijah, the prophet of God. Elijah, the man who had been faithful to the Lord. And Ahab sees him and says, you troubler of Israel. You're the one who's brought all of this heartache on us. There'd been a famine. There'd been a famine. People were starving. There was drought. Hadn't been raining for 3.5 years. Whose fault was it? Ahab said, oh, it's not my fault. I turned my back on God, sure. Not my fault, though. It's Elijah's fault. He brought this evil on us. And that's the way the world operates today. They bring all sorts of problems into our lives, all sorts of problems into our own souls and into our society. But it's never because of the evil that we do. So the evil of this human and demonic alliance is self-destructive. It says that these locusts have a king. Actually, Solomon tells us in the book of Proverbs that locusts don't have kings. They don't have leaders, right? That's part of the, you know, one of the anomalies is they are able to accomplish so much marching in ranks and files that they don't have a king. And yet they seem to get so much done. Well, here this locust horde has a king. And his name in Hebrew is Abaddon. And in Greek is Apollyon. And in both languages, that means destroyer, destruction. And we read at the enthronement of Christ at the seventh trumpet in verse 18 that in the day of his judgment, when he's seated upon his throne, and all stand before him to be judged. It says that he will destroy the destroyers of the earth. So Apollyon, Abaddon, the destroyer, will be destroyed. He will meet with the final judgment of Jesus Christ. And again, who is the king? Who is the king of destruction? Well, it's demonic? Yeah. It's human? Yeah. It's an alliance. And we need to beware. We need to beware. John is calling us to open our eyes and to see the world the way that God sees it. To see the world in the light of the kingdom of Jesus Christ is his reign. And as we come to know more of what it means to be in the kingdom of Christ, what's the character of his kingdom? I think the more we see what's wrong in the kingdoms of men, see the values of the kingdom of man. Okay, the things that are considered important, the things that are considered good, the things that are considered bad in the kingdom of man. We see that in the light of the kingdom of Christ. And we need... there comes a time, maybe multiple times in our lives, when we have to hear the call of Christ that we hear later at the when Babylon is falling, is come out of her, my people. Come out of Babylon, my people, lest you take part in her sins and share in her plagues, share in her judgment. So get out of it. And I think we have to do that like repeatedly in our life. And more and more that we realize, you know what? You know, this is not walking in step with Jesus. This isn't walking in step with the Spirit at all. This is walking the way the men are walking. This is walking contrary to God. And we have to flee from it. We have to get out of it and get our life in line with with the nature of the kingdom of God, submitting to the lordship of Jesus Christ. Well, are there any questions before we wrap it up tonight? Diana? Well, I think that suicide may be one way in which we see that kind of played out. But I don't think it's the only way, because, you know, we're told particularly here people want to die, but they won't find it. But, you know, so suicide in a way is like an escape. It is. I wouldn't say that every suicide is brought on because someone has just lived a debauched life. I mean, there are various reasons why people commit suicide, so I wouldn't want to lump everyone together. But I think that there would be cases where people have done so much destruction to their soul that they are despairing so much of life itself that would lead them to suicide, you know. Good question. Other questions? Garrick, did you want to have any comments you wanted to add or any corrections to my lesson?
Comment question is, when you look at verse 11 and it talks about his name in Hebrew being Abaddon and in Greek Apollyon, the destroyer, do you think that's part of the satanic trinity kind of counterbalance between, you know, God and Christ being the creator and then Satan as a destroyer?
I think that's a really good point. Yeah.
I think he picks up on that even in chapter 10, where he talks about, verse 5, and the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, and the earth and what is in it, and the sea, kind of contrasting with the destroyer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. Because you do have, just like in what the verse you just read from chapter 10, you have that tripartite view of creation, of, you know, heaven and earth and the sea. Is that how it was? Heaven, earth, and sea? You have that tripartite view of creation in chapter 9 here with the star fallen to the earth, but it's given the key to the bottomless pit, brings darkness, right, so that it blocks out the heavenly bodies and the air. So it's kind of like, again, the same, you know, threefold division of creation, using different terminology and different word pictures to give you that image. But yeah, so in a sense that destruction and devastation brought on to the creation in contrast to God's, you know, good and creative works. All right, well, Eric, would you mind having a word of prayer for us, and we'll have some fellowship in the back?
Lord, we're thankful that we can gather together and study your word, and Lord, that we can do it safely together on a regular basis. Pray that we don't take that blessing for granted. Lord, not only do we have your word, we have your spirit. Lord, now we ask that, Lord, help us to apply what we have learned in today's lesson to our daily lives. Help us not only to learn in our minds, but to live it out. And Lord, we are grateful that you have given us the seal and saved us from the torment, Lord, that we would be part of, but for your grace and mercy. Lord, I pray that the remainder of our time together and our discussions will be for your glory and honor.
Amen. Amen.